This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And this week, we're going to talk a little bit about the some Nigerian startups. You know, we've got a lot of students from Nigeria going to school in our New Delhi campus. And we have quite a lot of interest in our programs in the U.S. from Nigerian students. So I thought I would look at some of the startup environment within Nigeria and look at, in particular, at one IT startup company as kind of an idea of how things are going there. And then we would also, I'd like to explore a little bit on what we're calling the digital arms race. You know, we talk a lot about how cybersecurity is really becoming more and more important. And it turns out that the old Cold War with you know, mutually assured destruction with nuclear weapons is sort of morphing into a cold cyber war where we're building up reservoirs of vulnerabilities that we can launch against our adversaries at the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. And I'll sort of talk about that. It's an indication of the sort of our new defense posture, but it also helps show you where some of the good jobs may be located. And it was a huge, huge mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Giant. Big Voice. Giant mailbag. I can hardly get it up on the counter. We got an email from Rachel in Fairfax. 5 months ago, I bought a Samsung portable external hard drive. Now, it's come to my notice that these removable media drives can become very vulnerable to viruses or bugs that might affect them. So I'm a little worried about this. My portable drive is a third full of video movies. Now, I have hundreds of movies stored. Now, these movies are, you know, I've got to keep these. If I'd lose them, it would be terrible. I want to guarantee that they're going to remain safe. I want to preserve them for hopefully many decades to come. What can be done to ensure longevity and safety to the drive and its content? Thanks, Rachel in Fairfax. Well, Rachel, external hard drives are no more likely to be infected with malware than your internal drives. In fact, they're slightly less vulnerable since most malware infects systems that are stored on the internal drive. Your biggest risk is disk failure. Someday, without warning, your hard drive's going to break. And some fail sooner, some fail later, some stop without any warning, and then boom, they're gone. I've had drives over the years fail without warning. Now, sometimes if a hard drive fails, if it doesn't destroy the media, you may be able to recover the data. But sometimes when they crash, the head just drags on the media and destroys data. So here's the deal, Rachel. You really don't have a backup. You've got it one copy. In other words, there is no backup. So your external hard drive cannot be viewed as a backup because these movies aren't stored anywhere else. So you need to start backing up that drive of yours immediately. Now, a simple way to do it would be to get a second hard drive. Like you can buy a 1 terabyte hard drive. External hard drive, USB hard drive, Samsung, for around $65. It sounds like that's what you've got. So you can simply take the two hard drives, plug them into the two USB ports, and copy all the files from one drive to the other. Then they're actually in two locations. And so you're always backing up. So anytime you save new files to one drive, you save them to both. And then you would so you could actually plug both files into your computer, and you could, whenever you do backups or saves, you could do it to both drives at the same time. Then that would actually satisfy you as a backup. Now, what I do, I've got an external hard drive at home, but then I back up all my files to Carbonite. So then I've got backed up on Carbonite plus backed up on the external hard drive. So plus I have them backed up on my laptop. So I've got from three places actually, because if you've got two hard drives at home and then your house burns down, you lose them too. So, or if somebody breaks in and steals all your computer equipment, you lose that too. I mean, one time we had a 25 years ago, we had a break in at Stratford, and they stole the computers plus the plus all the backup disks that were sitting there.
Good grief.
So having your backup at a different physical location is also a good idea too. Now, what I think might be a good idea for you would be to get a RAID storage solution, R-A-I-D. Now, that stands for Redundant Array of Independent Disks. Now, you could get a two-disk RAID storage system, and you set up in the duplex mode, so whenever you save to the RAID storage device, it just saves to both disks automatically. And you then would have copies on each disk. So just to give you an idea, you could get a Buffalo Drive Station Duo, which is a two-drive USB 3.0 high-density redundant storage solution for backs up for PCs or Macs. Now, if you configure this to full capacity or to half capacity if you store in a duplex mode. In RAID 0, it's configured as one hard drive. So, for instance, if you get a 2-terabyte model and you go with RAID 0, you'll have 2 terabytes of storage with no redundancy. If you go with RAID 1, that's configured as 2 duplexed hard drives, and so your 2-terabyte solution will give you 1 terabyte of storage, you know, doubled up. And that's for $229. Given the fact that these are so important to you, I would get RAID storage. The nice thing about RAID storage is that you can plug it into your network and you can back up over the Wi-Fi. So your RAID storage device could be actually hidden somewhere, you know, hidden down in a cabinet, plugged into the network. So that way, if somebody comes in and steals your computer, they're not going to see your backup disk there. It would be hidden. That's what I would recommend. Then that way, you're going to get redundant storage without even thinking about it. And when you got valuable files, that would be, I think, your best bet. We got an email from Peter. Dear Tech Talk, I've been listening to you talk about drones for the last few months, and finally I got a Phantom Vision 2 drone.
That's the same kind you have.
Got the same kind I've got, and I love this thing. I'm flying it. Now, here's the trouble. My wife's a lawyer. And she said, I don't think you should fly the drone because it's not approved by the FAA. We could get sued. It could drop out of the sky. There could be all kinds of liabilities. And I just think it's too dangerous to fly. I need help. I want to fly this drone, but I want to have peace at home at the same time.
Good point.
What could you do? Well, Peter, let me give you the actual FAA regulations. Okay, the FAA regulations are in 14 CFAR Part 91. You know, this is for your wife. 14 capital CFR Part 91, docket number FAA 2006-25714. I'll post all this in the. So this is like written in legalese just for your wife. Mm-hmm. This is their regulations regarding unmanned aircraft operations in the National Airspace System. This notice clarifies FAA current policy concerning the operations of unmanned aircraft in the National Airspace System. Now we go down to the relevant section, which you're going to want to point out to your wife, the lawyer, which is called recreational sports use of model airplanes. It turns out that FAA defines drones as model airplanes. The fact that they got GPS and all, that's still just a model airplane. In 1981, in recognition of the safety issues raised by the operation of model aircraft, FAA published Advisory Circular AC-9157, Model Aircraft Operating Standards, for the purpose of providing guidance to persons interested in flying. Now, this guidance encourages good judgment on the part of operators so that persons on the ground or their aircraft will not be endangered. The AC, among other things, provides guidance for sites. They'd like you to avoid noise sensitive areas such as parks, schools, and hospitals. But my drone is quiet. I don't have to worry about it.
Police stations, you might add to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I like to buzz the police station. Now, maybe that's a bad idea.
Yeah, bad idea.
Now, hobbyists are not advised to fly in the vicinity of spectators until they're confident that their aircraft has been tested and proven airworthy. Now, they recommend that the aircraft be flown below 400 feet to avoid other aircraft in flight. This is why when I bought the Phantom, they recommended I stay below 400 feet. Mm-hmm. Now, typically, I stay below 1,100 feet. Which is just...
That's a little high.
Well, but they don't say you're required to stay below.
No.
They just
There's
recommend it.
There's a lot of traffic between 400 and 1,100 feet.
But I don't fly near airports.
Okay.
The FAA expects that hobbyists will operate these recreational models within a visual line of sight. When the AC-9157 was developed for model aircraft, some operators have used the AC as a basis for commercial flight operations. I'll give you a link to this, Peter. I think this should satisfy your wife. I'm certainly much happier because I was thinking maybe I'm glad that this letter prompted me to look this up. I feel much more secure now. I was just flying it without really knowing what the rules were.
Well, let me ask you this question. Do you think, in light of the fact that drones are really different than the traditional model airplane, mm-hmm. do you think that this part of the FAA regs is going to be altered at some point?
I think they're going to update it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also another part in the regulations that says that these must be for non-commercial use. So, for instance, where this brings it into question, suppose you were going to take wedding pictures,
right.
and so it's really for commercial use. See, technically, this doesn't meet the guidelines. And so there's only one commercial use of drone that has been approved, and it was approved in Alaska, where a bar was sending out beer over the ice to people doing hole fishing.
Uh-huh.
So that's what they were doing. And so that's what was happening there.
You know, that's funny. The Part 91 is non-commercial. I know this from my years in aviation.
Yes, yes.
91 is a non-commercial part of the flying regs. Look at what just happened.
I love you.
Look at just what happened.
You.
This is just so amazing that we have a guest. We have
that till I walk in.
Hi, folks. This is David Burke.
Don't stop.
He's here, and he's got his...
Hello.
Yeah, part of his music.
Some cheesy music, man. Can I get some decent music?
Yeah, you're gonna have to pull something out of it. Well, see, they only allow you certain music, which we have licensed rights for.
TikTok had a bigger budget than this, man.
We have no budget. What are you talking about?
I can't even get
you
a chip.
You guys don't know this, man.
We got to use whatever kind of free music that they allow us to have down here.
The guy's driving a Toyota Opel. I mean, this guy's got cash in his mattress. He can drive better cars than this. Come on.
So here's the deal. Now, Dave, I've now done all the legal work. I can fly my drone legally.
I've got
the FAA regulations fully set up.
Yeah. Send me an email with a link. I can do it legally.
That's right. I just want you to know that. Now, I can't do it for commercial purposes.
What do you mean? I mean, like if you want to deliver a diploma to
I want to deliver that. Or suppose if I'd want to take wedding pictures. See, technically, that would be commercial usage.
Well, this is a very good point because you were using the drone to take pictures, aerial shots of your camp.
Of my campuses.
Right?
Yeah, see, the thing is, we had the new Alexandria campus, and I was having the drone hovering about 100 feet above the beltway, taking a picture of the new campus.
So then do you think that technically could be a violation?
Doc, do you want to announce your new co-host pretty soon here?
Oh, yes. Well, we have.
It's David Bird.
Yes, Bird here.
No, although the intro said David.
Yes.
Are you chasing? Are you chasing me out of here?
No, I'm not. No.
So
nobody rocks salmon jackets like
so,
you.
So the thing is,
this is Nantucket Red.
You've been tracking all this stuff around the FCC net neutrality.
Yeah, net neutral. Please, more let down. Explain that in real human terms.
What
does that mean? Without getting all wonky on me.
What that means is that suppose you've got a carrier like Verizon, and they're selling you their entertainment package, but you don't buy it. You want to go with Netflix because you want to stream it in. Because Netflix
You've lost me already. I asked you a simple question, Doc. The president's been talking net neutrality. What does that mean?
It means that all websites will be treated the same way.
So like they aren't now?
No. See, like what Verizon could do, for instance.
Oh, in other words, you know, all the carriers have to abide by a common
code. They have to abide by the common code. And so, like you take an internet service provider, they want to sell you their own content.
Oh, yeah.
So what they would do is,
their own this,
so they would say all content which competes with our local content, we slow down.
Oh.
If it comes into our network, we slow it down. So we make it so it's got a buffer and it's slowing and it's such a poor service that you're going to take ours. And the only way that we're going to let that competing service have high bandwidth is if they pay us extra money.
So
the competing websites have to pay for extra service. So you'll have a tiered internet where certain websites can pay for better connectivity
Jimbo,
than other
you,
ones.
Are you as proud of him as I am right now?
I'm very proud of him.
He can dumb it down if he wants to. He really can.
You have to push him a little bit.
You got to talk with the people.
And so this
we're dummies over here.
So, real dummies.
So what this actually will mean is that, for instance, if Netflix has got to pay some fees to the internet service providers to deliver their content without being slowed down, they're going to have to charge you more money because the internet service providers have charged them.
Okay.
So the net result is you're going to have to pay more for Netflix.
Doc, well, I only have a limited amount of time.
Okay, yeah.
Let's get to it then.
I have to get back to the mothership.
Your real job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the real job, yeah, exactly.
This is the daughtership down here.
This is the daughtership, exactly. how long do you think television as we know it, meaning the networks, are going to be around? Because I'm telling you, I'm unplugging as of Monday. I'm going Netflix and Hulu. I don't care about anything else.
Yeah, I think it's.
I've even had people go over the air for their local channels.
Yeah,
and they go Netflix and Hulu.
That's what I think going over there because you've got digital TV over the air.
Right.
That is actually good enough.
Aren't you the one that told me to just get the rabbit ears, aluminum foil, and you're back in business?
You get the rabbit Tin ears, helmet. and you can get
you
a
touch
little
a certain thing in the back of your whatever your DVD or your
TV. You can
dongle.
You can get rabbit ears, and then you can get an amplifier because this digital TV is very signal strength dependent. So you can get for $30, you can get like a 100 dB amplifier.
Well, what I'm amazed at is the cable companies don't seem to be feeling the pressure. I don't feel it. Mm-hmm. They're going to be extinct here in about two, three years. I mean, that's what I'm thinking.
Here's what's going to happen. Why people hate cable, it's bundles.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
There might be one, like you might want to get one HBO channel.
Right.
But to get HBO, you got to get Disney, you got to get sci-fi, you got to get this whole gazelle, you got to get this big package, and you only want HBO. So what is going to happen is the carriers are going to debundle.
I hope so.
So that's where the competitive pressure is going to be. They're going to end up debundling, and because you can already the reason that we don't have debundling yet is that there are long-term contracts with these carriers, with the cables and Fios, that say Apple TV can't get or Chrome can't get, you know, Google TV. But once these contracts are up, you're going to find the content providers are going to sell to everyone.
Right.
And it's going to be who can provide the best unbundled service.
Doc, I'm sure you have. Jimbo, have you checked your bill? Have you actually
looked at the bill? I just updated it. Well, you know, I got a bundle.
I was floored. I was paying $180 a month.
Well, I have a phone line, a landline that I don't even use, that I don't care to use, that I said I don't want this. We have to have this to get this price.
Yeah, to get the triple package. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's only good for a year, and they don't tell you when it's up, and all of a sudden
I don't have a landline anymore. I've dumped my landline.
Oh, I know that story, Doc.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We're well aware.
There's no reach in the dock.
So David, so you don't care about like watching things real time. So Netflix and Hulu so when you Game of Thrones, you can deal with the next day.
You can get all the shows the next day. I mean, really, it's not a problem. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The only problem for me is news. I need to see the news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see the news. And so that's why you'd want to have the digital TV set up for the news. Yeah,
And there was a question here, which is now old age has eaten alive.
So there is a company that's providing digital TV over the internet,
and
by the way.
And that would be?
Yeah. Yes.
We're waiting for you, Guru.
I'm trying to.
You're going to post that on your website.
I'll post it. I can't.
There we go. Because I'm going to go leave right now.
You can't divulge to that.
That's right. And so the thing is, I can't remember the name of the company, but they have it. And there was an issue of can they redistribute material.
Is it Aereo?
Aereo.
Yeah.
That's it.
And
Aereo.
So what they do is...
The big brain on me.
...is they have each little transmission, it's got its own little antenna.
Right.
So they're saying that you've got your own private antenna at their
exactly.
central server.
Right.
And
you've
won
got
the court
TV.
Case.
Yeah.
So that service is not in the Washington area yet, but it's coming next year.
They're going
so
to be
once
very
that
prosperous.
Once that's here for like $10 a month, you can get all of the local TV channels
and Comcast. Bye, bye.
And then you don't have to worry about this rabbit ears and the amplifier stuff, which is kind of complicated.
I live in Baltimore City. I can only get Comcast. I don't have any choices. This is another thing that annoys me.
You can't
about
get Fios?
No.
Really?
Baltimore City is not wired for Fios.
Wow.
So you can't get Fios.
No,
at all. That's
really? Not in Baltimore City because I was so ticked off at Comcast.
Arrow's
going to
save your soul, and Netflix and Hulu will.
Well, the other question is, one of the real reasons I have Comcast is for Wi-Fi. But you can get your own Wi-Fi router, right?
It's you can just buy your Wi-Fi router, but you need internet access. You're not getting it for Wi-Fi, you're getting it for internet access.
So now we're back to the beginning again.
Well, no, if you just have internet, if you just use the cable companies for what they started off with, was the web, then just get the web. Mm-hmm. You don't need the TV, you don't need the phone.
Okay, now here's the deal. You could probably make a pact with some of your neighbors. You could all share one internet connection.
Wouldn't that be illegal, Doctor?
It would be.
And that way you could set up a Wi-Fi router.
Well, of course,
router.
I wouldn't do it.
You could set
I, of course,
the man, no.
Who invented war wagging.
And the antenna.
This works particularly well in townhouse communities where everybody's so close together.
So you basically have your own little neighborhood Wi-Fi network.
Yeah, and then you just all share the connection.
I remember him being in that rusted Dodge Dart with a big antenna hanging out his car.
Come on, son. We're going to go war wagging.
Let's go war wagging. Let's go, buddy.
I used to hang the cantenna. And then the cantenna out.
Yeah. Marianne was driving.
And so one time I was driving around with my laptop. I had my cantenna hanging out the door, and I was pointing at this building. Got pulled over by a policeman.
Oh, Lord.
No, that didn't look suspicious at all.
And I had all this electronic gear, everything turning on. Wow. And he was looking at this thing, and I said... Officer?
Yes, officer.
Is there a problem, officer?
Let me think of one.
And he was looking at this thing, deciding whether he should have had a search warrant or something. Because I really looked suspicious with my cantenna.
Oh, yeah, you did.
And he said, you made an illegal U-turn up there. And so I got a $30 ticket, and that guy was walking around the car, looking at the backseat, looking around everything. And then he decided... Okay, I think this guy's just a nerd. I don't think he's a terrorist.
Dispatch, I need the emergency response team, the hazmat crew here,
please.
I need
a canine unit here. Do some sniffing. Yeah, exactly.
So that reminds me, I'm going to have to do that again. I'm going to have to do some war driving again. I like to survey Washington to see how many people are securing their Wi-Fi network.
Ooh, I feel so exposed.
Give us the date. That's going to happen, so we'll be able to arrange, bail
to
for
dig
you.
A moat around my.
No,
Wi-Fi.
What I'm going to do is, when I drive from here to the studio, I typically will pick up like 2,500 to 3,000 access points on the way, and I can then give statistics on what percentage of them are not secure.
And you only stop at the juicy ones.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay, here we go. Doc, it's been fun, really.
David, thank you for stopping by. Appreciate it.
Do I have exit music?
You don't have.
Okay, so I just have to slime out of here.
Did you not hear me say that we don't have a budget?
No, you know.
We're going to play a little music. This is not David specific, though, okay?
This is perfect.
Very good. A little Steely Dan. Steely Dan, everybody. Okay.
See ya.
All right. Okay. Good night, everybody. Thank you for listening. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. We'll be right back right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. Now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
And today we're going to talk about Chad Hurley, Steve Chen, and Jawed Karim. Jawed Karim, I think. They are founders of YouTube, YouTube.com. Now, Chad Meredith Hurley was born in 1977 near Birdsboro, Pennsylvania. He's currently the chief executive officer of YouTube. He received a Bachelor in Arts from the Indiana University of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Right after he graduated in the year 2000, he got a job at PayPal, really working on their interface or user interface, some of the graphic design. And one of his first jobs, he had to design the logo for PayPal. They're still using the logo that he designed on while he was at PayPal.
Classic logo.
Yeah, that was the classic logo. Hurley is an expert on user interfaces and was primarily responsible for tagging and video sharing aspects of YouTube. The second founder of YouTube, Steve Shi Chen, was born in 1978 in Taiwan. Chen is currently the chief technology officer of YouTube. His family immigrated to the U.S. when he was 8. He attended the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. After graduation from college, he became an employee of PayPal. I see. You see there's a kind of a trend here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. PayPal connection mm-hmm. here.
That's right. Chen was also an employee of Facebook, although he left Facebook several months before he was involved in starting YouTube. Jawed Karim was born in 1979 in Marsberg, East Germany. He currently serves as an advisor to YouTube without a formal position. His family moved to the United States in 1992. He graduated from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He left campus prior to graduating to become an early employee of PayPal, but he finally did. His parents are happy to know that he finally did get his Bachelor of Science degree in 2004. As you might have expected, Chad Hurley, Steve Chen, and Jawed Karim met while working at PayPal. Now, YouTube was born one night when Hurley, Chen, and Karim wanted to share some videos from a dinner party with friends that they had in San Francisco.
That sounds terribly exciting.
Yeah, dinner party. But you don't.
Here's the veal.
You really don't know what kind of party it was.
Yeah.
It was on January 2005, and all of the data doesn't really tell the details of that dinner party.
Uh-huh. Basically, my understanding was that for the first like 7-8 months that the site was in existence, it was operated out of like one of these guys' garage or something.
Yeah,
it was.
I've heard that story. Yeah.
Well, they tried to find a way to share this video, but, you know, video is a big file.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't send it by email because it exceeded the size of the email attachments. It was hard to post it online because you couldn't get the right bandwidth, couldn't get the right interface. So they thought they'd try to design something simple. So they ended up creating a site where they could just post videos that they wanted to use personally so they could share them. And it turned out that this became a very popular site. I mean, they initially just did it for the fun of it, but it kind of became a popular site. Jawed uploaded the first YouTube video, the first official video, April 23rd, 2005. That was just 4 months after that dinner party. And I looked at that video, the first video. It was him. He was standing in the San Francisco Zoo in front of the elephants, saying, "Here I am, standing in front of the elephants, and it doesn't really look like they've got much to do today." I mean it wasn't really much of a video.
You know, the elephants really don't have much to do but eat and recycle peanuts
right.
and hay all day.
Now,
you know,
so they,
I like the way you phrased that. Very broadcast appropriate.
Thank you.
But I want you to, now listen to this timeline. April 23rd, 2006. The first video was uploaded. April 23rd, 2005.
Happened so quick.
October 16th, 2006, that's less than a year and a half, Chen and Hurley sold YouTube to Google for $1.65 billion.
That's amazing.
It boggles the mind.
You think about that. Yeah. I mean, less than a year and a half. Now, it turns out Hurley's share was $345 million. That was in he was awarded 735,000 Google shares, and at that time, that was $345 million. Google's gone up since then, so he's got a lot more. Chen's share was $326 million at the time. That was 625,000 shares of Google. Karim's share was $64 million, and that was 137,000 shares of Google. Now, YouTube was not even profitable. It had no ads. It had no source of money. They basically, Google just wanted to get it so they could lock up the video market, and they were going to try to turn it into monetize it, as they say, in some way with advertising, which they haven't done yet. Google has said that so far the revenues from YouTube are immaterial. But this is interesting. There are so many videos. There are currently 83 million videos on YouTube. The bandwidth for watching all the videos costs $1 million a day for the bandwidth.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah. It's
Now, there's one interesting side note here. There was a company called Universal Tube and Rollform Equipment Corporation, and their web address was YouTube. Well, that would be the letter U, Tube, instead of Y-O-U.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the letter YouTube.com. And people got confused when they went to YouTube because they would type the letter YouTube instead of Y-O YouTube, and their site was just crashed all the time with traffic. They finally had to sell that domain name, and now their name is YouTubeOnline.com, and they sold it to a copycat site that wants to also deliver videos. So there's a case. Three guys in the right were at the right place at the right time, and they made a killing when they sold that.
Do you think it happened so quick that we can't even think of a time that right now where YouTube wasn't a major integral part of everything we do?
Is it possible that they'll ever recoup all of what they invested in this?
I think eventually there's so much traffic going to the site. I think they'll eventually integrate advertising with it, just like they did with Gmail.
They're doing it now, but like you said here, it really is immaterial the amount of profits they generate from advertising because it's not across the board and it's only on selected videos.
Right.
Selected high hit count videos.
That's right. Yeah. You know, I've got a video on YouTube which I just discovered.
Do you really?
It was one of our promotional videos at Stratford. Somebody uploaded it on YouTube. When
no
I was
kidding.
Looking around, I found it.
I have some things on YouTube that I don't really want to talk about.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. More Tech Talk coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now,
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here.
And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Ross. I'm the adjunct professor for messing things up and lowering the academic bar here on Tech Talk Radio. We just finished talking about the founders of YouTube on Profiles in IT. When YouTube first launched, their web address interfered with another company's web address. If you can give me either that company's name or the web address that was affected, you will win tickets for two for fine dining at Stratford University, either the campus in Falls Church at the Escoffier at Stratford University or on the campus in Woodbridge at Cafe Karim. Now, if you're calling us from east of Birdsboro, Pennsylvania, the number is 877-936-9333. Calling from west of Merseburg, East Germany, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line, as always, is 877-936-9333. Andrew Mitchell, adjunct professor for crowd control and prize distribution, is standing by to take your calls again at 877-936-9333. The Pop Quiz from Tech Talk Radio.
All federal agents listening should turn off their radios.
Uh-oh. Right now. There it is. This is the music that we had coming into the radio station.
That's right. Now, what were you doing in the car on the way in here?
Orale!
This is what I do. This is my war-driving music. Whenever I'm going out and looking at the access points in the area, I turn on my war-driving music, open up the radio, open up all the windows, stick my antenna out of the car, and drive around. So what I did this morning, I set up my put up my laptop in the car. I opened up a program called NetStumbler, which rings a bell every time I get an access point, and it tells me whether the access point is encrypted, what channel they're using, the signal-to-noise, and all the other things I like to know. And then it catalogs. It also gives me the GPS location of that particular access point. And as I drive along, my laptop is dinging as I pick up more access points. I have my dipole antenna stuck out through the moonroof. I've got my Cantenna antenna stuck out through the side window as I'm driving around Washington.
And so when you get in the car, does it sound like this?
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
That's it. You know, that's what. Whenever I'm out going out with my son to do war driving, that's it. He says, "Okay, Dad, hit it."
Obviously, he didn't come this morning on this. How long of a drive is it from here to from your house to here?
Well, I'm down I'm a southern boy from Virginia, mm-hmm. So it's probably 20-25 miles, I think.
Okay,
coming in, and on the way to the studio, I passed 420 access points.
And that's interesting because a lot of the time you spend on that road, on that trip, you're on an interstate highway.
I'm on an interstate highway. Now, the one thing that was very noteworthy, last time I did, I always try to evaluate Washington, D.C.'s level of encryption.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time, a lot of my neighbors were unencrypted. This time, every single one of my neighbors had encryption turned on.
That's because they know you live there.
I wonder if I have changed their behavior.
You might have. But it's funny, you said coming down River Road.
River Road, I'm telling you, is not encrypted. Those guys on River Road just aren't really paying attention to encryption. That was the lowest level of encryption of any neighborhood in my drive coming in. I passed a total of 420 access points. Encryption was turned off on 148 of them.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Doesn't River Road go, isn't it entirely in Potomac?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but the stretch of River Road Doctor probably drives is inside the Beltway.
Inside the Beltway.
That's not so much Potomac, but that's still...
This is the thing, on River Road, from inside the Beltway until I hit the District of Columbia line, the encryption level was probably running less than 50%. I mean, my overall average was something like 70% was encrypted, or 65% was encrypted, but that dropped below 50%. Once I got into the district, encryption picked up. So out of the total run this morning, 148 did not have encryption on. That means that 272 out of 420
did turn on their encryption. They're the good guys. So the last time I ran this, I did this a couple of years ago, Washington was running about 55% to 60% mm-hmm. encryption. So actually, we're much better now.
Yeah, that's about two-thirds, 66% or so, isn't it?
Yeah, we're actually much better. Now, I was also interested in trying to figure out the level of technology. So this program, NetStumbler, also detects the access speed. It turns out that of the 420 access points, 365 of them, or 87%, were running 54 megabits per second. So we know that's 802.11g. Mm-hmm. That's the new technology, which actually has embedded in it the new encryption, WPA, WPA2. So we have the potential here of really being a very secure operation, a very secure town.
Well, once again, the benefit for encrypting your Wi-Fi is it's so other people don't get in and use it.
Yeah, really, it's not so much security, it's so that you don't have people hogging your bandwidth. Your neighbors say, well, why should I get internet access? You know, I just piggyback on my neighbors and I get it for free.
But by doing that, you open yourself up to potential viruses. If they go to sites that open their computer up to that, they could bring it in.
If your computer is not firewalled, mm-hmm. if you don't have a firewall on your computer so your hard drive's accessible to other people on your network, you could get viruses. That's probably unlikely if most people do have an internal software firewall on. But if they don't have it on, because you see, when you get onto the network, you are inside of the hardware firewall on the wireless network. Now, one of the big problems is, suppose your neighbor's son downloads illegal MP3s. Those illegal MP3s, of course, have been downloaded to your IP address.
Right.
So you're going to be the one who's sued for copyright infringement,
exactly.
Not your neighbor.
Exactly. And encrypting your Wi-Fi is actually very simple, isn't it?
It's extremely easy to do. You actually have to log on to your wireless access point, and it actually has a built-in web page. So you just have to go to the web address of your access point, and the web address is almost always the same. It's an IP address, and you can look it up in the manual. It's 192.168.0.0. In another case, it might be .1 at the end. So it would be 192.168.0.1. You just look it up in the manual. You go to that web address, and the web page comes up. And then you log on to your access point. There's a username and user ID. And the default username and default user ID are in the manual. It's usually something like the administrator is blank and the password is admin. Or it could be admin username, admin password, something very simple. It depends on the particular brand. You log in, and there's a section called encryption, and you simply enable encryption. And you select whether you want what type of encryption, WEP, WPA, or WPA2. If you've got old computers in the house, you probably have to go with WEP because the old network interface cards only support that. But if you've got all new technology, you go for WPA, WPA2, which are more secure in that they have what they call a rolling key. The key changes often enough so it's hard to basically figure out the key quick enough. And you just simply select a key, and the access points, most of them have an automatic key generator for you. So you let it generate the key for you. You enable that key, write down the key so you don't forget it.
Good idea.
And then when you log on the next time, your computer says, this is an encrypted channel. What key is it? You type in the key that you saved in your access point, and you're in. And if your neighbors don't have that key, they can't log in, so there's nobody's going to be hogging your bandwidth and maybe eavesdropping on your whatever you're doing if you have anything you don't want your neighbors to know about.
We want you to know that Tech Talk Radio airs every Saturday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, online at techtalkonline.com and at federalnewsradio.com. Stand by. More Tech Talk coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay.
If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Let's talk about Nigeria.
Let's do that.
You know, we set up our campus in New Delhi so we had so many students from India. And surprisingly, we ended up with around 40% of our students in New Delhi are from Nigeria.
No kidding.
It's quite amazing. You know, I just discovered my earphones are not working, but that's okay.
Why would that be?
I don't know. So I'm going to talk about sort of the profile of a Nigerian startup.
Let me point out that this is a technology show and we can't get headphones to
I
work.
I know.
This is kind of sad.
If I move them in and out, it's not working,
it's
but
not
that's
working.
Okay. I can survive because I am a radio professional.
Yes.
I'm
you
a
are.
Radio professional.
Well, I'm going to walk around the board here. You talk. Let me see if I can work on that for you.
Okay. So in 2008, there was a man by the name of Aburisima Adarasit. He returned to Nigeria after studying for a degree in information systems and management at the London School of Economics. Now, he felt that the internet could transform the business landscape in Nigeria. In fact, that was the focus of his dissertation, The Impact of Technology on Small Businesses. By internet standards in Nigeria, those were really the early days. Facebook was just picking up. No one had really heard of Twitter. Internet advertising was almost unheard of at the time. And so he said, I'm going to do something about it. So he decided to set up this company that would help small businesses advertise. There was this one small business called Baby M. Baby M. Now, this was a small business which catered to the needs of new mothers and their babies. I guess it was Baby and Mother, Baby M. I don't know where that name came. So it operated only one store in Lagos, near where Abbas lived.
Mm-hmm.
See, his full name is Basasiama.
Good luck with that.
But people call him Abbas for short.
his mom called him Abbasimia.
Abbasimia, yeah. But Abbas, his friends just called him Abbas. And so there was this little Baby M store near where he lived. And they had a network of sales agents, and they would comb the streets of Lagos and search for customers. You know, they'd just go out. They'd say, you know, Baby M's down here. Do you need any baby clothes? Do you need anything? And they would just, like, do door-to-door selling. So, you know, Baby M's, you know, monthly sales just with this sort of this network of, like, you know, in-home agents was, you know, in the order of about $1,000 a month in sales. It's not really a lot. I don't think they were making much money. So a boss tried to convince the Baby M's owner to give him a chance to show how the internet could help her advertise cheaply and find new customers. Now, at first, she wasn't very keen. You know, she said, come on, I got my salespeople, this internet thing. My customers aren't going to use the internet. I think it's just dumb as dirt. And so he said, look, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a money-back guarantee. If I fail to give you the number of customers that I'm promising, I'll give you back all of your money. So with that, she decided to just give him the whole amount that he was asking for to help her do internet marketing. And she gave him cash, which was the equivalent of $250. That's almost 25% of her entire monthly income. The results were actually phenomenal. Within 3 months, Abbas says that Baby M's revenues grew from $1,000 a month to $100,000 a month.
Now, that's pretty good.
Pretty good estimate, you know, pretty good, you know, return on investment, $250. Now, this feat actually attracted the attention of Google. And they've actually then featured this company as an internet marketing case study. Now, shortly thereafter, Abbas said, you know, I think I better, you know, get my company incorporated and actually form a real company. So he called it Wild Fusion. And he started doing for other businesses what he had done for BabyM. Now, Wild Fusion's growth has been remarkable from its founder's first $250 in seed money. It had over $1 million in revenue in 2012, and wow, it doubled that to $2 million in 2013, which in Nigeria is a lot of money. This was the first Nigerian company to become a Google AdWords partner. And today it provides digital marketing and online media buying services to a clients list that includes companies like Unilever, Pepsi, Diamond Bank in Nigeria, Vodafone in Ghana. Now, while the global corporate spending on traditional media, such as TV, radio, and print, has declined or stagnating in the last few years, internet advertising budgets have steadily grown and will continue to grow in the foreseeable future. This shift began to become noticeable in Nigeria, and everybody from banks to beer companies is now seeking to actively engage customers on the internet. Wild Fusion just opened a country office in Nairobi, Kenya, and its third office is going to be in Nigeria. After Nigeria will be Ghana. In 5 years, Abbas envisions to open offices in Africa with annual revenues of $100 million.
That's amazing. With $250.
$250. And I'll tell you, this is indicative that the economy in Nigeria is booming. So the digital arms race is actually an interesting thing. This has been a long-term trend line as we've become putting everything that we have on the internet. I mean, all kinds of factories are controlled on the internet, the power grids on the internet, hydroelectric systems are on the internet, even people are putting their refrigerators on the internet. And so now people are taking advantage of all of this rich source of internet targets. And the Cold War has been replaced by the Coders War. Even experts are surprised how fast the online threats have developed. It's taken less than a decade for digital warfare to go from theoretical to possible. Now, in 2007, you might remember the attacks in Estonia. These were distributed denial-of-service attacks. They swamped the banks, the newspapers, and all the government sites. And they were basically making demands on the government, and they were shutting down all these systems until those demands were met. NSA shortly thereafter warned of something called a BIOS plot. Now, this was work of an unnamed nation which exploited a software flaw in BIOS. The BIOS is the basic input-output system of a computer, and it would allow them to destroy the BIOS in any PC and render the machine unusable. So, you know, when the machine is booting up, it's actually reading the program from the BIOS. Mm-hmm. So if they could go in with a flaw in the BIOS and overwrite the BIOS code, they could actually trigger that at will, and they could render the computer inoperable. So there was a lot of work on sort of trying to protect yourself against the BIOS flaw. Now, the U.S. has been building up its own capabilities, and you can see why this BIOS flaw is important. Suppose that you would put that BIOS flaw on all the computers that your enemy had controlling, you know, say, you know, their defense radar systems. And then just before the attack, you implement the BIOS flaw, reboot the computers. The computers are then inoperable, and then you attack. So these kind of flaws, if they're stored up and available, could be devastating at the time of attack. Now, the U.S. has been building up its own capabilities to strike if needed. Now, the only documented and successful use of the weapon was the Stuxnet worm, mm-hmm, Stuxnet. Now, this was masterminded by the U.S., and it was designed to damage the Iranian nuclear program. It used a day zero exploit in Windows. It was actually carried into the Iranian enrichment plant on USB thumb drives. So they basically infected the computers of people that worked around the plant. Then they would take a thumb drive to work, they'd put it in at work, and then it would get in the system. And there were basically these devices that were connected to the enrichment devices, which would spin, and they would basically have the enrichment devices spin too fast and burn out the motor. But they, but it was done in a way that the Iranians didn't know that it was spinning too fast. And so it basically, they lost about a year because their enrichment machines kept failing prematurely, and they kept having to replace them, and they didn't know what was going on. And for some reason, the Obama administration bragged about this, and so everybody knew about it. I don't know why they even talked about it. Now, last year, General Alexandria revealed that NSA was building 13 teams to strike back in the event of an attack on the U.S. Now, the U.K. is spending over £500 million a year on cyber warfare. Peter Singer, director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institute, said that 100 nations are building cyber military commands, that, and about 20 of those are serious players. We're seeing a classic arms race like we saw in the Cold War. The big difference between military-grade cyber weapons and hacker tools is that the most sophisticated digital weapons want to break things, like those enrichment devices. Mm-hmm. SCADA, which are called SCADA is an acronym, S-C-A-D-A. It stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Systems, are being internet-enabled in order to make them easier to manage. So switches in the electric grid, control, say, for dams, you know, which control the motors, all sorts of industrial functions in factories are all controlled by SCADA devices. And in order to reduce labor costs, they're saying, well, you know, we shouldn't have to walk around to adjust these things manually. Let's hook them up to the internet, and we'll just all control them with our central control center. Well, that means all these SCADA devices are, of course, then vulnerable to attack. And those exactly, it was the SCADA devices in Iran that actually allowed them to go after these enrichers. Zero-day flaws are relatively rare. These are flaws that have been undiscovered in an operating system, and they're expensive and hard to come by. They're sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars, they're finding. Now, once an attack's been launched using a zero-day exploit, everybody knows it, like in the case of Stuxnet, as soon as that became abroad, as soon as that was generally known, once it was launched and Stuxnet spread everywhere, security companies started changing the code so that they would be protected against that particular zero-day exploit. So, but cyber warfare has raised some difficult issues. I mean, what about attacks that don't cause physical harm? Do they constitute an attack under the laws of armed conflict? So what are the rules? Okay, if I hack your power grid, is it fair to shut down my central bank? And at what point am I justified to send a missile over there and use conventional warfare to fight back? We haven't really defined the rules of engagement on cyber warfare. Now, a recent study warned that cybersecurity efforts around the U.S. electric supply network are fragmented and not moving fast enough. And you can see what would happen if there were going to be an attack and they would bring down the power grid. It would just shut down everything. And as we connect more and more devices, especially ones in our home, cyber warfare is even a greater effect. We're even putting thermostats, you know, the Nest thermostat. We're putting refrigerators. We're putting cars on. We even got cars on the internet. And so what would happen if there would be some SCADA attack and we just shut down all the cars or shut down all the refrigerators?
This is sort of like a modern-day electromagnetic pulse, right? Everybody feared that if there was an atomic attack. This is sort of the cyber version of
It's a cyber version. This is actually becoming an issue, but this is also an opportunity. So those of you that want to get into computer technology, this is a hot, hot area. Cyber security. We love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu so we can cover them on the show. I might get back to you directly. I want you to go to Tech Talk Online and check out our podcast. You can also go to Apple iTunes and check out the podcast. If you go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating so that we get more listeners through that venue. And also check out all the Stratford University programs at stratford.edu and let them know that you heard about them on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and Federal News Radio. This